All right, I've got a fresh squeezed lemonade for you, Annie. And an orange whippleberry smoothie with extra whipped cream for you, Freddy.
Thank you. This looks good.
Yummy.
That hits the spot.
There is really nothing like grabbing a tasty beverage, kicking your feet up, and relaxing during a long day of exploring the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind our favorite Disney attractions.
You can say that again, Annie.
There really is nothing like grabbing a tasty beverage, kicking your feet up.
That's not what I meant, Annie.
Well, either way, guys, it's great to be taking a load off and beating the heat like that, this, here in Mickey's very own house.
I can't believe we're really able to book a personal one-on-one interview with the mouse himself.
I can't believe that he's just letting us look around his house while we wait for him to finish up the shoot he's doing in his sound studio barn in the back of the house.
It really is a dream come true for me.
There's so much to see inside this place. Every wall and surface of this place is a love letter to the owner of the house.
You're right, Annie. The Imagineers who built this place for Mickey really used every inch of the territory to pay tribute to the mouse who started it all. I mean, from the moment we walked inside, we were hit with a wave of history, nostalgia, and amazing details that give us a glimpse into Mickey's rich past. Did you happen to see the photo of Walt and Mickey up on the wall by the front staircase?
Hey, good eye, Freddy. You know, I think so many people are distracted by the door that Pluto smashed through in his hurry to get upstairs that they tend to miss the tribute photo to Walt and Mickey's relationship. I think there's a really good reason why this is one of the first things you see when going into the house.
I think you're right, Al. Walt really is as much Mickey as Mickey is Walt. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
The two are forever linked together, one giving us insight into the other throughout the years. These two were working and creating together something magical, and they knew it. You can see some of those examples of Walt and Mickey's work together in the images on the wall. Look, every picture on the wall is like from one of the projects that Walt and Mickey did together.
That's amazing.
Clearly, Mickey is also a very avid sportsman, by the way. That front closet was filled to the brim with various different outdoor and sports-related equipment.
No doubt, Annie, an homage to all the shorts we've seen in the past featuring Mickey and the gang engaging in some pretty wild extracurricular antics.
The music sheet over on the bureau also reminds us that Mickey is a well-rounded Renaissance man as well. A master of the physical and musical. I like that.
Yeah, he can do anything. Truer words were never spoken. I'm amazed at just how much stuff there is to see in his living room alone. Look at this. There's so much stuff. I can't help but ignore my aching feet, you guys, and let's just explore this place all the way through.
Ooh, I'm right behind you, Freddy.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, wow, guys. Take a look at that lamp over there. It's in the shape of a car. This is a model of Mickey's famous car we see in all the shorts, as well as the modern-day Mickey stuff on networks like Disney Junior.
He's such a hot rodder. I believe we'll also see that car featured in an upcoming attraction we'll be exploring sometime soon.
Oh, look over there. We get a little glimpse into the daily routine of Mickey himself.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. A daily to-do list. Okay, so let's see here. It says, wake up at 5 a.m.
5 a.m.? Oh, I have literally never seen what the world looks like at that time of morning. In fact, I'm pretty sure the world doesn't exist at that time.
Oh, Al. Apparently, Mickey is an early-to-bed, early-to-rise kind of guy. Al, very much like you.
Not at all like me, Annie. But he and I do have something in common. We both start our day with a rousing session of mousercise.
Mouser what?
Oh, come on, Annie. Mousercise, it's all the rage amongst the rodents. Let me tell you, there is no better way to get the blood pumping than to throw on a hot green unitard, your favorite pair of leg warmers, and an oversized sleeveless tee, and sweat to some truly epic tunes.
Okay, Al, that is literally the worst mental image I have ever had.
You're welcome.
Make it stop.
You'll notice, though, that Mickey's next item on his list is to play with his pal Pluto before eating a nice, balanced breakfast.
Freddy, is it true that Pluto was named after the planet, or protoplanet, or whatever it's categorized as now?
Well, now that is a subject that's up for debate even to this very day.
Yeah?
Yeah. You see, when the dog we know as Pluto debuted in a 1930 short named The Chain Gang, he was just a nameless hunting hound on the trail to recapture an escaped Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse was on the lam. But only a mere 6 weeks later, this nameless dog would become known as Minnie Mouse's dog, Rover. But by 1931, this dog magically received the name Pluto for the first time in the short called The Moose Hunt.
Well, that's some great history, Freddy, but it didn't really answer my question about his connection to the planet.
Well, that's where things get interesting. So, as the timeline goes, the nameless dog, then subsequently named Rover, appeared in early 1930. Pluto, the then planet, was discovered March 24th, 1930.
Oh, so the planet was named after the dog?
Well, not exactly. Okay, the planet was named by an 11-year-old girl named Venetia Burney Fair, who just thought it up one morning while eating her breakfast.
And that's why Mickey always eats a balanced breakfast.
Wait, what?
Nothing. Continue.
Okay, listen. As I was saying, when Fair named the planet, Pluto, the dog, was named Rover. But Walt and his gang of animators believed a name like Rover or Spot for a dog was way too generic. So according to legend, one day Walt comes in and says, "How about the name Pluto the pup?"
So he did get the inspiration from the newly named planet?
I think I'm fogging things up a little too much. Nobody really knows. So some Disney historians believe Walt named the dog after the planet in order to capitalize off the new planet craze. But there's nowhere in the Disney record that definitely proves that to be the case.
So essentially the jury is still out on Pluto's name origins.
At this point, that's exactly right.
And now you know the definitive truth, Annie. or don't know, or are not sure like the rest of us. Anyway, so take a look on the next item on this list. After watering the lawn, Mickey needs to call his gal Minnie. Oh, how romantic.
Aww. That's romantic, but it's also practical too. I mean, look, at Mickey's rigorous work schedule, on his to-do list, he's got to set up a time to meet with his girl. And he's also got to be on set in time to greet people at 6:30 a.m.
Wait, on set?
So remember, Annie, the reason the Toons moved here in the first place was because there was ample space to create their cartoon shorts. In fact, according to the official story that frames the land, the story that we talk about in our Toontown episode that folks should go back and listen to, Mickey had a barn built behind his house to shoot these shorts away from the hustle and bustle of Hollywood land.
Indeed. I'm always trying to find out new and fun ways to shoot my shorts. This working out of... Sorry, folks. I'll get back at it. Indeed. This working out of a barn harkens back to Walt's barn that he used to tinker in during his free time. So it always goes back to Walt. Then that's where Walt would work on his train set, his miniatures, and then dream about a park that one day would allow people from all over the world to visit and create lifelong memories.
Wow, that really creates an even deeper meaning to Mickey's movie barn. He and Walt seem to be connected in so many ways.
They really are.
Oh, guys, look over there in that bottle. It's the Steamboat Willie Steamboat.
Oh, you're right. Look how it even bobs up and down on the waves inside that bottle. It's puffing red-hot smoke, billowing out from its blackened smokestacks.
This has to be a reference to Mickey's first appearance on film, Steamboat Willie, right?
Now, again, that's another interesting and complicated story.
I'm all ears, Freddy. Wait, what was that?
I think it came from the radio set over there.
Oh, wait, what time is it?
Time for you to get a watch. Zaha!
Oh, haha, very funny. Oh, it's that time.
What time?
Time for the Disney History Hour on KWDI, Toontown Radio. And what perfect timing. This week's episode is all about the origins of Mickey Mouse himself.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's go give it a listen.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Disney History Hour, brought to you by Clarabelle's Creamery. I'm your host, Snerdly Ritlaw. This week, we focus on the history of one of our most beloved members of the community and hear about his storied, controversial, and clandestine creation. That's right. On this episode, we'll be exploring the storied history behind the one, the only, Mr. Mickey Mouse.
The story of Mickey Mouse begins all the way back in the mid-1920s. Walt Disney was fairly well known due to the popularity of his famous character Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. This character was a simply drawn black and white rabbit that looked remarkably like Mickey Mouse with longer ears and feet. Oswald starred in the Disney shorts that entertained audiences before feature films would roll at local cinemas. Think of these as the Disney shorts you still see at the beginning of all Disney and Pixar films today. These shorts were adored by both audiences and theater owners who wanted more and more of Oswald. Now, at this time, Walt Disney Studios was so small that no one really knew who they were, so they had to team up with a bigwig studio that theater owners did know in order to get play in cinemas. That studio was Universal. Now, a producer at Universal by the name of Charles Mintz saw Walt's potential as a storyteller early on, and he loved the animation work that was created by Ub Iwerks. Ub Iwerks is a character that will have his own episode on this show due to the fact that he's a major factor in the creation of Disney as we know it. But for the sake of this story, we really only need to know that Iwerks animated everything from the Disney studios at that time. It's also very interesting to note that Walt never actually animated anything that Disney is truly known for, characters like Oswald, Mickey Mouse, etc. Walt was at best a mediocre animator, and he realized that. But where Walt lacked in animation skills, he made up for in creativity, vision, and drive. So with Walt as the creative force, Iwerks as the master animator, and Roy Disney, Walt's brother, as the financial whiz, Mintz couldn't help but take notice. So he drew up a contract that funded Walt's vision, and Universal had a character in Oswald that would draw audiences to theaters. So at the height of Oswald's success, Walt took a trip from the Disney Brothers Studios in California to Universal headquarters in New York to renegotiate Disney's contract with Universal. Walt was especially excited because he knew the success of Oswald would lead to a stronger contract and more money to fund Disney's upcoming projects. So Walt and Lillian packed up and jumped on a train headed for New York. When Walt arrived, he excitedly met with Mintz, anticipating big things. And boy, were there some big things to come. Over the next few meetings, Mintz informed Walt that Universal would be taking over the production of the Oswald shorts. Walt was confused. Mintz went on to explain that Oswald was a major success, but also a major financial drain on Universal due to the high cost of producing the shorts. So, to save money, Universal essentially stole Disney's team of animators by hiring them as Universal employees to create the shorts instead. Walt was flabbergasted. They couldn't take a character that he had created and make the shorts themselves like this. That would be absurd. But Mintz went on to inform Walt that he didn't have a say in the matter. Mintz reminded Walt of the contract that had been signed. Within the document, it stated that Universal owned the rights to Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Walt had signed away his biggest star and personal creation. Mintz bid Walt good day, and Walt left Universal Studios without a character, without a crew, and without a job. Walt was devastated. Everything he had spent the last decade building had just been stolen from him by Charles Mintz. He had no plan, but he knew the employees he had left would panic if they knew what had happened in New York. So Walt sent a telegram to his brother Roy, telling him not to worry, that everything would be okay, and that he would explain in person once he got back to California. Walt knew that he had bought some time to think of a plan during his trip from New York to California. It was during this time on the train ride back from New York that Walt Disney's life would change forever. Walt, racked with stress and anxiety from the loss of Oswald, had to go back to the drawing board, literally. He needed a new character. It was there on the train that Walt created the idea for this new character that he called Mortimer Mouse. Now,
Now, mice had always enchanted Walt, and he believed that mice hadn't been used too much in movies at this time, so it was a great idea to go with. Now, Walt loved the idea of the mouse character, but he wasn't completely sold on it. After all, could he base his future, his career, his reputation on the back of a little mouse? After Walt returned from that fateful New York trip, he, Ub, and Roy gathered and started brainstorming ideas. They created concepts for everything from horses and cows to dogs, but none of these characters had the it factor they were looking for. Walt had thrown the mouse character out as well at some point during these sessions, and for some reason or another, it had just gotten lost in the shuffle. It isn't clear what caused the mouse character to eventually stand out to the crew, but there are a few tall tales, theories, and otherwise great stories about it. One of the reasons some say a mouse stood out is due to a friendship kindled by Walt and a mouse back in the Kansas City days. While running his first studio, Laugh-O-Gram, Walt had supposedly befriended a little mouse that he would train to do small tricks. The mouse was supposedly fiercely loyal, as was Walt to the mouse. The little rodent supposedly even made the trip to Los Angeles with Walt after the failure of Laugh-O-Gram. Now, Disney purists will discount this story for many reasons, but it's been told so many times that it can't be ignored as a major part of the Mickey mythos. Ub Iwerks claimed that the mouse caught his eye due to a poster created by a Disney animator. This poster was of Walt Disney surrounded by a small group of mice, and for some reason the poster always caught the eye and imagination of Iwerks. There's no denying that all roads pointed to a mouse. And though some would claim that it was for mundane, practical reasons that a mouse was chosen, I like to believe that the creative process leads strong creators back to the things that bring most inspiration. And from the collected stories around this period, mice were on the minds and hearts of all creators in that room. So it was decided, the next big Disney character would be a mouse. But what would this mouse look like? Well, the original design for the mouse would be created by Ub Iwerks. The creative team of Walt, Roy, and Ub would come up with many designs for the character, but the three all strongly agreed on one drawing of the mouse that Iwerks had come up with during one of their meetings. The character was made up of small circles put together to create an insanely simple yet overwhelmingly effective character design. It's interesting because the original design of this mouse looked remarkably similar to Oswald. So in a way, one could say that Oswald and Mickey Mouse are related. Of course, there's nothing in the Disney lore that suggests that there's any official relation between the two, but they really do look very similar. So once the mouse was settled on and designed, Walt took the idea to his wife Lillian to get her opinion. She loved the idea. Well, mostly. She loved everything except the name. She felt like the name Mortimer just wasn't the right name for the character. She suggested they use something a little more hip and with the times. She suggested the name Mickey. Walt, never one to pass up a great idea, loved the name Mickey, and it's stuck ever since. They had their new character and were ready to start making the magic they knew the Disneys were capable of. But there was just one problem. The problem was, now that Walt had his new character, Mickey Mouse, to work with, he had to keep it a secret. Now, why did he have to keep this secret? Well, Walt was still under contract with Universal and Charles Mintz, the man who had stolen Walt's animators as well as Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Basically, anything Walt created belonged to Mintz and Universal per their contract. So Walt decided that Mickey was going to be his creation and his creation alone. So in order to keep Mickey, he had to keep him secret from Mintz's grasp. So Walt and Ub Iwerks, Walt's head animator, started developing the design and initial stories for Mickey Mouse in secret. Not just secret from Mintz, but from any other employee of the Disney company who may potentially leak this new character. After the two had the final design for the mouse in place, Walt commissioned Ub Iwerks to animate two short pieces starring their new Mickey Mouse character. Now, many people widely know Steamboat Willie as Mickey's on-screen debut. But believe it or not, Steamboat Willie was actually not the first short made starring Mickey. No, Walt and Ub created two previous short films, Plain Crazy and The Galloping Gaucho, starring our favorite mouse.
These two films would be fully animated by UB Iwerks and UB Iwerks alone, due to the need for secrecy. But Iwerks was more than up for the challenge. Iwerks was a human machine who could churn out up to 700 drawings per day. In fact, he was able to fully animate Plane Crazy in a mere 2 weeks. Plane Crazy also showcases Walt's ability to innovate with the medium. The film is actually known as the first animated film to use camera movement as well. During the production of Plane Crazy, the two actually piled books under a certain spinning background animation to give the effect that a plane was crashing into the ground. Both Walt and UB were thrilled with the outcome of their first Mickey short. But audiences felt otherwise. Walt, excited to finally have Plane Crazy, his first short starring Mickey Mouse, premiered for a small audience of May of 1928. Needless to say, the reception of the piece wasn't astounding, and Walt left the theater without somebody picking it up to distribute the short. Walt tried to pick up distribution elsewhere, but was met with closed doors, and in some cases, even hostility. One theater owner reportedly told Walt, "Your stupid brain and your stupid mouse character can get out of my theater." In Hollywood, no distribution means no future. Walt's future was dead in the water. But as we know, Walt was a very headstrong and determined person who never took a closed door in the face as a reason to give up. Instead, Walt realized that if he wanted these Mickey shorts to be successful, he needed to innovate the way audiences interacted with the film. And Walt knew just what to do. In 1927, the movie The Jazz Singer was released. The film's plot was far from remarkable, but the technology used in the film is what set it apart. The Jazz Singer is the first commercially successful feature-length film to use synchronized sound technology. For the non-film nerds out there, this means that The Jazz Singer was the first film to introduce sound. Before this point, films were silent or occasionally accompanied by live music. But The Jazz Singer changed everything for viewers and filmmakers. If you want to see a more creative portrayal of what sound did to the film industry, watch the classic musical, Singin' in the Rain. I promise you will not be disappointed. Anyway, Walt was one of the many moviegoers who sat in a theater and took in the wondrous sound technology displayed in The Jazz Singer. He knew if he was to make Mickey Mouse stand out amongst viewers, they would have to not only see the mouse, but hear the mouse. Walt was going to make his next Mickey short a talkie. Walt's inspiration to make the next Mickey short a talkie was no easy feat. No one knew if this sound film was going to be successful or not. After all, no one had ever created a soundtrack specifically to accompany an animated film before. Walt needed to test the idea. At this point, his contract with Mintz was over, so the secrecy about Mickey Mouse had thankfully disappeared. Walt had the film animated and scheduled a showing of it for Disney employees and their families at the Disney studios. But this premiere would be a little different. Walt gathered a group of employees behind the sheet the film was being projected on and provided a live version of what Walt envisioned the soundtrack to include. Animator Wilfred Jackson played harmonica, while UB Iwerks banged on pots and pans as the percussion section, and a man named Johnny Cannon provided sound effects with slide whistles and spittoons, with Walt Disney himself providing all of the voice work. After the piece ended, the ragtag team of soundmakers were greeted with such excitement and exhilaration that Walt thought the audience was making fun of them. He said, "I thought they were kidding me." So they put me in the audience and ran the action again. It was terrible, but it was wonderful, and it was something new. It was this new idea that was going to get Walt the distributor he needed. Now he would just need to find a way to record and sync the sound. Walt Disney had his mouse, had his movie, but he still needed one more thing, his soundtrack. Now keep in mind, this is 1928. Sound technology and commercial film is less than 1 year old. so the majority of theaters weren't even equipped with sound systems. This meant that Walt not only needed to sell a film, but also a sound system that accompanied said film. So Walt traveled to New York City to shop for candidates to create his new sound system that was needed to project the sound needed to accompany his new Mickey Mouse short. Walt would talk to a number of companies, but eventually chose to work with a man named Pat Powers. Powers created a sound system that he called Cinephone, which, why can't we have awesome names for our technology like Cinephone anymore? I digress. Unfortunately, Powers stole the Cinephone technology from a man named Lee DeForest. This is thievery that would come back to bite him in the future, but that is definitely another story for another episode. Now that Walt had his company who would create this technology, he needed a group of performers to create the music and sound effects that would be displayed through that technology. He would turn to the Green Brothers novelty band to perform the music for the short. The musical score for Steamboat Willie would be a mix between the iconic tune Turkey in the Straw and the song Stingboat Bill. Turkey in the Straw was actually chosen for the soundtrack simply because the song was part of the public domain, meaning that Walt could use the music for free. As a side note, Walt chose the majority of his early film ideas from fairy tales for the exact same reason, because public domain properties are free to use. Anyway, the song Steamboat Bill would be chosen as an homage to the film Steamboat Willie parodied, Buster Keaton's famous Steamboat Bill Jr., which ironically is a film inspired by the song Steamboat Bill. The band recorded music without any issues, and the sound effects for the film were recorded fairly easily, but the problem came when they tried to synchronize the sound with the film itself. Now, it's important to step back and talk about the two different types of technology that were used in the early 20th century to deliver sound to theater audiences. The first technology was called sound-on-disc technology. Sound-on-disc was essentially a record played on a phonograph that was situated behind the screen in the theater. They would sync the sound on the record to match the movement and action seen on the screen. This was the technology that was used in The Jazz Singer. The second type of technology was sound-on-film technology. This process involves recording the soundtrack directly onto the film strip instead of a secondary disc. Sound-on-film technology was cutting edge, but also in its infancy. Because it was such a new technology, it was prone to being finicky and in many cases completely failing. For Steamboat Willie, Walt decided he would use the more cutting-edge technology of the two, sound-on-film, even though he knew the risks involved. Unfortunately, his gamble didn't pay off, and the first attempt to synchronize the sounds to the film failed miserably. The soundtrack lagged ever so slightly with the film, and as a consequence, the film looked sloppy and amateurish. Keep in mind that sound-on-film technology is also not cheap, so when he got the news that the synchronization had failed, he was devastated. The Disney Company was also still in its fledgling phase, so Walt had to sell his prize Moon Roadster vehicle to finance a second synchronization attempt. The first synchronization failure also came in part from the band not being able to fully follow along with the film. So Walt had a bouncing ball animated over the film that would allow the band to follow the music's timing perfectly. This technique was very effective, and the second synchronization attempt was a massive success. Steamboat Willie premiered at Universal's Colony Theater in New York City in November of 1928 to enormous praise. The film's original run lasted 2 weeks and played before the feature film Gang War, a widely unrecognized film today. The Disney Company was paid $500 per week to run the film, which at that time was an amazing amount of money for an animated short. Gang War disappeared into the ether of a bygone film era, but Steamboat Willie garnered attention, a lot of attention. Everybody loved the synchronization of sound and animation. The success of Steamboat Willie made Walt Disney an international icon of creativity and innovation. The film's success also shot the popularity of Walt's mouse into the stratosphere. The success of Steamboat Willie also allowed for Plane Crazy and The Galloping Gaucho to be re-released as sound shorts.
Both of the shorts in turn were also wildly successful, and the name Mickey Mouse has only grown in popularity since.
And that's, as they say, the rest of the story. Join us next week as we continue to explore the lives of the founding members of Toontown with the story of everybody's favorite Dippy Dog, the one, the only, Goofy. Good night.
Man, I'm learning so many new things today.
Me too. My brain is so full of knowledge, it's kind of making me a little hungry.
Well, Al, we have plenty of time before we have to meet Mickey. Why not just take a little trip into Mickey's kitchen now and fill up your stomach that way?
Not a bad idea, my friend. I think I'll do just that. You know what? Why don't we save the rest of the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details for a part two of an exploration of Mickey's house after I get a little bit of a snacky.
And Al, as you head into that kitchen, please watch your head.
And watch your step.
Thanks, guys. If I happen to miss my step and hit my head, I'll be sure to watch my language.